now the A side of the second tape of the interview of Dick Rowe on May 24, 2004. If somebody's looking for the other tape is A and B side has been filled. We've been talking for an hour and a half about this, and we're now going to go back to Dick Rowe and continue the conversation that Dick Rowe was talking about with respect to the Louis Loss Code and his presentation to the staff in terms of trying to get the SEC to follow his recommendation on the code. Dick?
Well, I started to say that the second thing was that the courts had become used to interpreting the statutes as they were. There were flaws in the statutes, obviously. But the staff had become used to interpreting it, and no action letters were now, or interpretive letters were now public. Beginning in the early 80s, they became public. So they were available. And we were concerned that if you adopt this code with a whole new set of provisions and a whole new set of definitions, that you throw out all of that prior SEC interpretation, the judicial interpretations, and you start all over again, and 20 years from now, people get some certainty. So it could create a great deal of uncertainty. The third major concern that we had is that this was a carefully crafted code. Everything was interrelated with everything else. And if you put a piece of legislation before the Congress, it's not going to sit there and pass it verbatim. There are going to be pressures put on Congress to change this and that and everything. And once you change one piece of that code, it has effects all over the code. And what you're going to get is not what went in. It's going to be like putting beef into a grinder and coming out with hamburger. So those are the three major reasons, wholly apart from substance, that we concerned, and there were substantive concerns too.
As it turned out, the commission did do almost everything it had to do with very little help from Congress. The commission did it all administratively. Integrated disclosure didn't have any congressional help whatsoever in terms of its proposal and adoption. The fact of the matter is it took things like the beginnings of the shelf rule and adopted it, which for all intents and purposes allowed companies to achieve company registration with the universal shelf registration statement 10 years after integration began. And the Sarbanes-Oxley Act is a wonderful example of your third reason. Once Congress gets a hold of the federal securities laws, Sarbanes-Oxley is a very good example of what happens.
But anyway, Professor Loss was sort of offended by these young pups questioning his code. But it never got support at the staff level, and therefore it just sort of died. An honorable death. If you go back and read the volumes of the code, there's a lot of historical background in the volumes that is very useful. You know why things were done this way and not a different way. But anyway, Al Sommer for a long time never forgave me for not supporting the code. Although after a few years, we became good friends again. If I may, John, I'd like to spend some time on sort of the administrative side. We've been talking about rulemaking and the excitement of that, and we're talking about enforcement cases. I'd like to spend a little time on what I would call the administrative side of things, because after all, I was running a division with 350 employees and doing budgeting work and interacting with the people on the administrative staff.
As a person who started as an examiner in branch number 2, I'd love to hear about the administrative side. Well, those of us at the bottom of the boat who were rowing would like to know.
Let me start out with and some of the people that were very important to the commission and probably don't get as much credit as they were. first of all, I think I start with the Office of Personnel. The first director of personnel that I came in touch with was Harry Pollack, who was actually Herb Pollack's brother, and did a good job. And he was succeeded by a gentleman named Al Fontes, F-O-N-T-E-S.
Well remembered.
And I had most of my interaction with Al, and I'll tell some stories on that. But after Al came Jim Foster, who I just was a delight, and I really got along well with him.
Yeah.
Al and I had some interesting controversies, shall I say. One was a young, as you mentioned, I did a lot of the vetting of the hiring of young lawyers, even when I was director. And it came across my desk, a young man, Bruce Mendelson, had a tremendous record, and I interviewed him. Great. Said, hire him. Fontes comes storming down to my office. He said, how could you do this? What are you doing? I said, did you know that this guy is the son of Sidney Mendelson, the director, your colleague director of who was the predecessor of the Division of Investment Management? I said, no, I didn't. I said, if I did, I'd still hire him. I said, I didn't know. Sid never talked to me about him. This is all on the record, all substance. He's got a terrific record. Here's his record.
Mm-hmm.
Hire him anyway. He growls, but Bruce went on to a fine career at the commission, and he's now in private practice.
Yes, he worked with me in disclosure policy, and Bruce Mendelson was one of the people that actually tackled management remuneration, executive compensation during the early 1980s.
And then second thing that I remember is that we had a rather senior lawyer who was very valuable to the division, and the commission has rules as to what investments you can have and what kind of accounts you can have and everything. And this guy had come out of private practice, and he had two accounts, which I don't know, were family accounts or something, but they were on the prescribed list. And he didn't even think about it. I mean, he wasn't doing anything wrong. There wasn't very much in the accounts. He wasn't trading. So the boss comes down and says, nope, got to go. He violated the rules. And, we fought for this guy. We fought for him, and he finally lost. I appreciate that if you have rules, I guess you have to follow them, no matter how hard it is. And that was one of the hardest things I had to do is fire people.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of my colleagues didn't want to go through the grief of firing people, not only because from a human standpoint, which was the hardest point for me, but if you fired somebody, you were going to get an EOC complaint or you're going to get a grievance of some kind and have to go through a proceeding. And I said, look, if we have a solid record that this person is not performing or is a danger to the agency, I'm going to fire him, and I'll take the heat. I'll go to the hearings. But don't worry about it. We'll do it. And I've done that, and I've gone through hearings. And and luckily it was few and far between, but it was hard, both from a personal standpoint in some cases and just because of the grief that you put through by having to go through a hearing. But the interesting thing is that Fontes, who I've had some tangles with, comes to me one day and said, I need your help. I need my help. So I have had a complaint lodged against me. And in those days, the commission would allow commission lawyers to represent commission employees who were subject of internal complaints. So I want you to represent me. So I said,
you would represent Mr. Fontes?
Yes.
Yes.
So I said, fine, I'd be happy to represent you. So I took on the representation, and I get a motion to disqualify from the complaint. And then I saw, without getting into the details, I filed a counter motion to disqualify the complaint, which never went anywhere. But But I said, okay, fine. I'm not going to have a secondary controversy here. I'm off the case. But my two best lawyers are on the case, Barbara Leventhal and Dick Nesson. Of course, being disqualified, I don't know how it came out in the end. But it was interesting to have my sometimes adversary coming to me if I want you to represent me.
A compliment of no small proportion. But the operations of the Division of Corporation Finance is where the heart of the entire division is.
Right.
The review process.
And then, yes, in the review process, I must say that I never worked in a branch, a reviewing branch, and I never worked in assistant director's office. It was always through the enforcement side and the disclosure side and then up to the director. So I relied very heavily on the associate directors and the assistant directors and the branch chiefs, for that matter, but people like Ralph Hocker,
mm-hmm.
who was the principal associate director under Al, who actually ran the place. Ralph could do some very interesting things. The Sarbanes-Oxley Act has a provision that says you will review the reports of public companies at least once every 3 years. Well, you know, the commission in those days, under its budget or its operating budget, had to review the 34 Act reports and clear them every year. And that was physically and practically impossible. They spent a lot of their time on the 33 Act, which had been historically where the commission focused the thing. 34 Act reports got very little attention. For a long time, there was very little in them, but even afterwards. And I became curious as to, how do you meet this clearance? And I can't remember now whether it was Ralph Hocker or Bob Bagley, his predecessor, said, very easy. He pulled over a list, and he signed the bottom of the list, and it said clear. Well, those guys operated that way. But the one I remember the most and most fondly is Bill Wood, who was the associate director for operations when I was the director, and I relied so much on him, and he just ran the place. I mean,
Bill Wood was the associate director for operations when I ran the place, and he ran the place as well.
And the assistant directors also were, historically, they've gone through various iterations, but in those days, they were assistant directors and then branch chiefs.
Right.
And the assistant directors were people like Mark Capel and Joe Bernstein, Ernestine Zappoy, were really the bulwarks of that.
Actually, during that period of time, it was sort of standard operating procedure that a branch chief, in order to be a branch chief, you had to be in the branches for 10 years. And before you even became an assistant director, you had to have about 12 to 15 years of experience. The backbone, the institutional memory of the division was the assistant directors and the branch chiefs.
Absolutely. And that was where the bulk of the work was done. On the other side of it, on the accounting side, again, I'm not an accountant, although I have been chair of the ABA's Law and Accounting Committee. I was graced by having Howard Hodges as the chief accountant of the division, another person who I could rely on completely, although he would be amused at my lack of understanding of bookkeeping. But
yes, actually, Howard P. Hodges was the chief accountant throughout the entire time, and he was the chief accountant throughout the entire time I was a division director as well. One of the best accountants you'll ever see, and capable of doing something that I would submit to you is increasingly rare, balancing the needs of accounting with the practical needs of a particular company in order to get transactions done.
Right, which is something that is important that the division had its own chief accountant, because the I won't call them ivory tower, but the chief accountants to the commissions are more involved in setting accounting policies and making rules that then have to be applied in a practical manner, and that's kind of the division. And During my tenure there, there were three chief accountants, I believe, to the commission, starting with Andy Barr, who was feared and loved by everybody, very protective of the profession. I can remember working in administrative proceedings, and there were several 2E proceedings recommended that Andy didn't think were in the best interest of the commission or the accounting profession, and they never went anywhere. And Andy could, the commission just relied on him 100%. And he was, you know, the powerful, powerful man, and the accounting firms looked to him. And just the story, when I first got there, there was no such thing as casual Friday at the commission or casual anything. The accountants would all dress like Andy, which was with a straw Panama hat in the summertime, and a blue suit and a white handkerchief in the pocket, and a gray fedora in the wintertime, and the same. And you know, and we wore suits. And I remember when we used to come in on Saturdays, when Saturday work was de rigueur, whether you had anything to do or not, Ed Worthy would let us come in sports jackets and ties.
Dressing down.
But Sandy Burton was the next chief accountant that I worked with. And I worked very well with Sandy, except in one area. There are things called staff accounting bulletins, which are guidance put out. They're not rules of the commission. They're guidance put out by the staff of the commission. And they got their start under Sandy, and it was a good idea, except for one thing. And I told the commission this. I said, look, you may say they're not rules, but practitioners violate these things at their peril, because the staff is going to adhere to them. So I think they ought to go through some kind of rulemaking process, or something like a rule, put out for comment. And this went on, Sandy and I, back and forth with the commission. The commission finally got tired of it, and they said, okay, we're going to resolve this. I said, well, how are you going to do it? From now on, no staff accounting bulletin goes out without the signature of the director of the Division of Corporation Finance. So they threw it back. I didn't bother them anymore.
Well, I mean, in terms of that, that tradition continued until the 1990s, and it's no longer the case that the director of the Division of Corporation Finance has to sign a staff accounting bulletin.
But they still recite that it is the views of the Division of Corporation Finance.
I appreciate that, but it doesn't go through the director anymore.
Okay.
Much to my chagrin, because the point that you're making is an outstanding point, which is the Corp Fin director should be signing off on staff accounting bulletins as well as the chief accountant of the commission.
Particularly since it has their name on it. But, and the last was Clarence Sampson, who came up through the ranks.
In Corp Fin.
Yeah, and then went to the chief accountant's office and became chief accountant. Very good chief accountant.
He then went to the FASB.
Right.
And he was a member of the FASB for almost 10 years.
Okay. More on administration. Budget. I hated the budget process, I must say. There used to be the finance director. And Frank Donnity was in charge of finance at the commission. And in the old days, I mean, he would draw up the budget. He could take it up to his friends on the Hill and the staff and lay it before them. And, you know,
presto, changer.
Presto, it's gone. And then it started getting these creative management theories as to how you ought to budget. They more or less change every year, but they're all the same. And so as director, I would have to go through this budgeting process and justifying the staff and protecting how many registrations they're going to be filed that particular year. And also, it was interesting the way these things would be set up, because it would be set up along functional lines so that I would have in my budget the Office of the Chief Accountant of the Commission, because that's disclosure. And I would tell whoever that is, the executive director or the budget director, I have no control over what those folks do. I don't have anything to do with them, other than, you know, typical. Nope, they're in your budget. I also had the records. No, I didn't have any regional.
No regional disclosure?
No, because the budget may have been moved already. I don't recall now. But if it hadn't been, it wasn't in my budget. But or I can't recall it was in my budget. But then I also had the records people. Because, you know,
ORs.
Well, it wasn't even ORs in those days. But filings come in through them, they're yours. They're in your budget. Anyway, it was a...
You also had zero-based budgeting under Jimmy Carter.
Zero-based budgeting, and then there was some other kind of budgeting, which seemed to me to be the same as zero-based budgeting. Anyway, it got done.
To provide a context, to provide a record for people who served the commission during your time frame, who were some of the people that you dealt with on the staff?
Well, in no particular order, and if I leave somebody out, and I'm sure I will, I should not feel slighted. It's either my memory or the press of time, but they all contributed. The first one I would think of is Orville Dubois, who was the secretary of the commission and also acted as the chief hearing examiner, and he was the PR person, and he did many other things, and he was one individual. Now I don't know how many people perform the functions that were
fleets of people,
but many, many. And he was an institutional memory, as is Jack Katz today. But and then there were people in market regulation like Ezra Weiss and Bob Block, who there was a rule in those days, 10b-6, which is now Regulation M, but nobody except Ezra and Bob understood that. I mean, they were Talmudic scholars as far as 10b-6 is concerned. If you wanted to know anything about how that rule operated, you had to go to one of them, and I think Ezra actually may have written a book about it. But
sort of like Mike McAlevey with the net capital rule.
Mike Macaroli.
Macaroli, yes. That's
Mike McAlevey would be very happy to know that. and another, what I would call Talmudic scholar, is Alan Rosenblatt, who's still there, I think, the commission of the general counsel's office. But at the time, he was in the investment management division. And if you wanted an interpretation of the Investment Company Act, Alan was the person to go to. And you really didn't want to go to him because you would not get the answer that you wanted, but anyway, he was very well versed in that statute. Some of the people in the general counsel's office, in addition to Phil Wimbus and Harvey, who I mentioned, and I guess Brad Cook when he was general counsel, Dave Ferber, who was the solicitor to the commission before Paul Johnson, was a terrific appellate lawyer. Jake Stillman, who was an assistant and an associate GC, and may still be. Jake still there?
Yes, he's a solicitor now.
Jake taught me how to, I mentioned earlier on that we got in the assistant director, when I was assistant director of the enforcement office in Court Finn, we got the authority to file complaints in court. Jake taught me how to draft complaints. So I was very happy to have him. Kathy McGrath, who was in our division for a while and ultimately became director of the investment management division and went on to private practice and was very, very successful there. She was one of the, when Alan Munson left, I took the opportunity to increase the diversity of the division's upper staff by considerable amount with people like Nikki Beach and Ruth Appleton, who was head of our branch of small offerings regulation, and Kathy was among them.
Ruth started as a file clerk, didn't she?
Yeah, Ruth was one of the pioneers of the women on the commission staff, and for years she was not. I mean, everybody thought she was great, but she didn't get much recognition. I mean, I think we finally convinced the personnel people. I don't know how many pints of blood we had to give up to do that, but she ought to get a promotion to an assistant director.
In the middle 1970s, Ruth Appleton was the chief of the Office of Small Business and Tender Offers.
Yeah.
And she administered tender offers without ever being a lawyer.
Okay. Neil McCoy, I mentioned, who was the chief counsel of Corp Fin, went on to very nice practice here in Washington with Skadden Arps, was my associate director for legal. Carl Bedelis was the first chief of the Office of International Corporate Finance. Carl has since passed on, but he was responsible for the first shot at 20F, which is the registration and reporting form for foreign private issuers.
And for most people outside the United States, Carl Bedelis was the SEC.
Yes. Some of my contemporaries that were division directors when I was there, Andy Klein in market regulation, Alan Mostoff in what became investment management. I mentioned Sid Mendelson, a predecessor now. Stan Sporkin, obviously. I remember once that there was an article, a full-page article in the New York Times, where the power lies at the SEC. And there are pictures of Kathy McGrath and me and Harvey Pitt and Andy Klein, and I believe it was Sid Mendelson at the time, was better than I am, the division directors and the general counsel.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it was true. The part about Harvey getting in early in the morning was not. Harvey would stay late at night. But I used to get in early in the morning because I got to do my best work early in the morning. And I would call Harvey and he wouldn't be there. And, but if you wanted to come in at 1 a.m. in the morning, Harvey was there. So. Let's see.
You have people like Paul Danson?
Paul, yes, Paul. When I was considering leaving, Paul was one of the people I tried to get to come in to fill a deputy director spot, and so I would have a successor, but Paul wisely decided he would keep that what he's doing. A lot of the associate directors down in enforcement, Ted Levine, Ed Hurley, Erwin Borowski.
Ted Sondy became an associate director in enforcement.
Yes, he did, eventually. Dick Kraut.
Okay. Wally Timoney.
Wally Wally and I over the years. Ted and Wally and I guess were probably the Ted Sondy and Wally and I were probably the closest of this. I worked with them quite a bit. But you know, these days they talk about silos,
mm-hmm.
and the different divisions, which silos is a new buzzword, but it means the separation between and how hard the chairman is working to try to break down the walls of the silos. They didn't have silos in those days. As I say, Stanley Sporkin wanted to talk to me, he summoned me to his office.
Not only do I agree with that, but you mentioned Ted Sondy. Ted Sondy's experience with me was the Beckman Dickinson case, and based on his experiences with you, I was the person brought in from Corp Fin to help on unconventional tender offers. And the whole theory of the Beckman Dickinson case was a joint effort between enforcement and Corp Fin. My highest honor as a young attorney in the Division of Corporation Finance was I was able to sign a complaint in the Beckman Dickinson case. And the fact of the matter is, I agree totally with you with respect to this point. There was not just coordination and cooperation, there was good arguments, very spirited discussions, and a community of interest with respect to the divisions that were not silos at all. They were all on the same team.
a couple of others. Ed Green I've mentioned, but Ed succeeded me when it was clear that I was going to leave. Started interviewing people. It's another story, but started interviewing. We can get into that too. But started interviewing people to be deputy director, and
that was a brand new position.
Yeah, Neil McCoy had left, and he was de facto deputy. But Harry Williams wanted to create the deputy, and two of the people that I interviewed were Ed Green and John Fetters, who later became director of Division of Enforcement, and we all agreed that Ed would be the one, mm-hmm. and Ed later became the director and then became general counsel of the commission. A gentleman that you and I both know, a branch chief, but also a photographer, Charlie Lebert, who was responsible for the portraits, or at least my portrait.
All the portraits up to Linda Quinn. I don't think he took Linda Quinn's portrait, but okay. he certainly took mine.
Yes, all the division directors' portraits were taken and hang in a conference room and at the commission's office. Interestingly enough, once I was over there for some reason, and I said, you know, I've never seen my portrait hanging. So whoever I was with, oh, come on, we'll show you. They opened the door of the room, and they were having one of these international visits from a Japanese delegation, and I could see all these people looking at me, standing there in the doorway, and then looking at the
They call it the pictures. The staff calls it the pictures, and sometimes when all of the division directors are there, the staff will say the pictures are here.
A couple of other people, Dave Butowski, who was sort of my opposite in the investment management division and in enforcement, who since passed on. A number of the regional administrators, in those days we spent a lot of time with the regional administrators, Len Rossen,
mm-hmm.
Jerry Boltz, Bob Davenport in Denver. Jerry was all over, so I won't attribute any particular effort to him. Ed Qualwasser, who was in the Reg A branch in the Washington Regional Office and since became the Executive Vice President of the New York Stock Exchange. Jack Bookie in Seattle, Bill Sheaf all over the place, and later went over to the NASD. Mike Stewart, Mike Walensky.
Mike Walensky was Atlanta, if I remember correctly.
He was also in the general counsel's office. Rich Tucker in L.A. was on the staff. You know, he wasn't the regional administrator. And my favorite of them all, Alex Brown, who was head of the Washington Regional Office. And after he retired, he went around to retirement communities, retirement homes, and sang for the older folks. And here's a man in his late 70s. But Alex was quite a character, and I really enjoyed it. Some of the executive assistants to the chairman, Art Fleischer, who was Bill Carey's executive assistant, Leonard Lyman, Mike Eisenberg and Dave Ratner for Nanny, Sandy Whitman for Bill Casey. Sandy was an interesting character. Any time there was a dirty job to be done, Bill Casey would say, and the staff was saying, Billy shouldn't be doing it. Bill would say, Sandy, Tim Green for Judge Fudge, Ralph for Howard Williams and Rod Hills, Bob Kraft, I think, was with Rod Hills too, Harvey for Ray Garrett. Ray was one of the nicest people that you could ever have met, and as chairman of the commission, he was just great. But I used to frustrate him. My first experience with Ray was that I was a young lawyer arguing a confidential treatment case before the commissioner hearing examiner, and Ray was arguing on the other side, and I had come up with this novel theory that. It was a public interest standard, and I was arguing that it was in the public interest to disclose this information. And Ray thought I was arguing that it was a violation of 10b-5 not to disclose it. And that was not what I was arguing. So he settled the case. He was turning red. And then he would listen out to staff, and he would find that what they were saying is reasonable, and he would go along with them. But you could see he was very frustrated. That's not where he wanted to go. But he was very humble. Some of the legal assistants I worked with, Jack Doherty, who's mm-hmm. Dick Smith's assistant, and we're still friends. Sven Johansson, who was Hugh Owens' assistant, but I lost track of Sven. Some of the people in the commission that I got to know outside of the commission, like Dave Reuter, who later became chairman, but I met him before, mm-hmm. and there were others outside of the commission that that contributed to the commission, were there before I was, or even never there, but still practitioners like Ken Bialkin and Jim Cheek and Marty Lipton, Jim Treadway before he became a commissioner, Jim Sargent was a former commissioner, Sink Armstrong was a former commissioner, Mel Friedman, Mel Kroll.
How many years were you there?
Well, I started, if you count, 63 when I was there in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
I started in 64. I left in 69, came back in 70, and left in 79. You do the math, Jim.
So about 12 or 13 years total.
No. I have a 15-year pin.
So the math
I think I got credit for my Marine Corps time.
The math is 16 years. Why did you leave?
Well, there were a confluence of reasons. One contributing factor was Stan Sporkin called me up. You know, Stan left the commission and became the general counsel of the CIA under Bill Casey, later a federal judge. But Stan called me up one day, just out of the blue, and I thought, oh, here we go, another summons. And he just started barking about saying it's no fun anymore. And I suddenly realized, no, he's right. And I always said, you know, I want to do something that I'm having fun doing. And I said, no, it's not. So that was one reason, although it wasn't a determinative factor. I thought I had accomplished everything I had set out to accomplish in terms of rulemaking, setting up the division the way I wanted it run. Quite frankly, I had three kids, and I was starting to think three kids are going to go to college, and the house is getting too small for us, and Congress keeps cutting back or not letting our salaries increase. And while my wife was working, between the two of us, we were barely making ends meet, so that was a very important consideration. Over the years, I have been given a lot of headway by the chairman that I had worked with, Rod Hills, who was surprising enough would take my recommendations, notwithstanding what some of his executive assistants thought. And Harold Williams had a different management style.
Mm-hmm.
He worked through his executive assistants. It took a long time to make decisions when I thought maybe decisions had to be made, whether they were right or wrong,
right.
Faster.
He also pit division against division at the time.
Well, I'm not so sure of that because, because of division directors got along, but in a sense, who had his ear at that particular point in time? And I'll give you one example. The commission was outgrowing 500 North Capitol Street. Staff was just too much. And I wanted to move part of the commission over to some buildings over Louisiana Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
And the first choice was to move Market Reg over there. And Andy, rightfully so, went to went to the chairman and said, you know, it's kind of destroyed the morale of my division, et cetera, et cetera. So I asked Harold to hear me out. And I said, you know, splitting the division is if they were to move some of the branches over there, splitting the division is going to be an administrative monstrosity. You know, we didn't have emails in those days. We didn't have all of these modern communications. You know, for people running back and forth. And, you know, I can also argue the morale factor, but I'm arguing as a practical matter, you're making a mistake. Well, I got this opportunity to make this argument in a car running to the airport for 5 minutes. Be that as it may. So the upshot was that they moved our people over there. I don't know whether that was the right decision or the wrong decision.
It was the wrong decision. As a person who used to go shuttling back between North Capitol Street and the old building, and which was a Federal Home Loan Bank Board building,
it was
exactly what you thought. It was an administrative nightmare.
Well, and I also remember that once they're over there, that they had the feeling that they were sort of lost over there. I went over there one day and I was visiting with Ernestine's employee in her office, and there was this tremendous racket. I said, "What's going on?" I said, "They're cutting a stairway through the concrete next to her office."
Mm-hmm.
It's not even worth it. Well, then it came summertime in Washington, and the temperature's up like it is today, 90s. And the air conditioning doesn't work very well over here. And I went
I don't think there was air conditioning.
Whether there was or not, it wasn't working. And I went to the executive director. I never got along too well with executive directors either.
Was this George Kendall?
No, this was Ben Milk.
I see.
And I said, "Ben, you got to do something about this. This is not the chairman's job. It's your job. You got to do something about this." He said, "They can open their windows."
It's 95 degrees out, and they can open their windows.
And that's so. Anyway. You know, for all those reasons, and then I just happened to come across an opportunity with the firm that I'm with now, and it sounded very attractive, and I like the people. So I made the decision.
Bottom line, what would you like people to remember in terms of Dick Rowe as division director of the Division of Corporation Finance?
Well, there's a movie with Jack Lemmon and somebody else, which I can't remember, but the other guy says the department, I think it was.
Yes.
And he says to Jack Lemmon, "Be a mensch." I remember as a mensch.
Yes.
But no, I was given a plaque when I left the commission, and I think it had something on it about the tender offer rules and the going private rules and maybe a few other things. But you know, some of the rulemaking projects. But if you could really go back to what there was a poem, and I don't have it. Couldn't find it, but there's a poem that Ray Garrett wrote about Al Levinson and Gene Gleason and me writing Rule 144. And if I stop and think about the most important thing that I did when I was there, is that we wrote Rule 144 and saved the legal profession and our clients millions and billions of dollars by just getting that rule out there.
In one fell swoop.
In one fell swoop. That was it was a great time. And I would do it over again. I met a lot of nice people there. I still have contacts with many of them. I wish I had contacts with more of them. I miss those that have gone on. And it's a terrific place to work.
Exactly. And I can tell you just from personal experience, being an examiner in your division and being a special counsel in your division, you were one of the best division directors the commission ever had.
Thank you, John.
Came from the 34 Act, and what this was a one-stop shop with respect to disclosure for both statutes.
Well, that's correct. The S forms were 33 Act forms, and the K forms were the 34 Act forms. Don't ask me how they got those, except maybe it comes out of some letter in the code of federal in the U.S. code, but we decided that it didn't make sense to have registration forms that under both acts that just repeated what the disclosure ought to be, that it ought to be standardized. For example, description of business ought to be standardized in a 10K and in a S-1 registration statement, and if you're going to go to incorporation by reference, it made even more sense. So you would have the disclosure items in one place. And we, I can't even remember now what went in at first, but we started out small after I left.
There were about four items when you were division director.
After I left, and the proposals under Ed Green were put out, the American Bar Association, Federal Regulation and Securities Committee got involved, and Warren Greenenberger, who became head of the committee at that time, actually moved to Washington to because he felt he went to their Washington office, his firm, because they thought he had so much work to do on this, although he had to go back because Ray Garrett passed away. But, and Warren came to me and he said, look, we you know, all these guidelines and other informal pronouncements by the staff of the commission, you know, all of this thing that regulation has to take. So we need somebody not to, to work so much on the substance of what's being proposed, but just reorganizing all of this. So he put me in charge, and I was now in private practice.
Mm-hmm.
And we wrote an extensive comment letter to the staff about just reorganizing the guidelines and the SK and you know, what should you put here without really getting into the substance. And it was something that the commission and the staff really welcomed, because they were dealing with substance, and this was important, but you know, not something they wanted to spend a lot of time on. So they got the guidance and they practically adopted it.
In toto. I became the chief of the Office of Disclosure Policy when Ed Green became division director. Not only do I remember that letter, that was the letter that was used as a guide with respect to the beginning part of integration. Because while all of this stuff had been talked about, all of the factors had never been put into one place, and your letter put it in one place. I want to...
Before we leave that thought, though, that demonstrates, and which has become more and more important over the years, is what the private bar can contribute to the commission's rulemaking proceedings, because particularly in my day, more less so now, there was little private practice experience on the commission staff, and the bar can import for the commission staff the practical consequences of their rulemaking, and in some cases, as the one we've just been discussing, you know, really lay out things that would be very helpful to the commission and staff. I mean, there are going to be disputes over substance, but over the years, it's worked very well.
And over the years, they haven't been politicized or viewed as somebody with a cause.
In most instances, there are occasions, but.
I want to conclude the part about rulemaking with a story about Dick when he was division director, and the fact of the matter is I was a rule writer under him, and my favorite rule, the rule that I love the most, is 14E3. When rule 14E3 was adopted, the commission had an open meeting. This was under the Government of the Sunshine, and the press was there, and this was the beginnings of, in essence, a press interview of the staff after the commission meeting. 14E3 was insider trading in the context of a tender offer. By the time it got adopted and Forstner actually understood that it was an important rule, the fact of the matter is, when Dick and I walked into this, in essence, press conference, they started asking Dick all sorts of questions about 14E3, which, incidentally, he could answer every one of them because he knew that rule cold, he knew the release cold, and he looked at the reporters and said, talk to John Huber, he's the person who worked on this release. The fact that a division director had, in essence, directed the reporters to talk to a young staff person about a rule was a moment in time for me that, quite frankly, I'll never forget. It became my operating philosophy that the contact people with respect to any release were not the senior people. The contact people with respect to a release were the junior people. It was their curtain call. It was their credit. It was the thing that would cause them to work real hard. And I learned that lesson from Dick Rowe. And I just want the tape to reflect that I thank him in public.
Well, I think that our successor, John, has done a very good job in giving credit to the younger people who work on these things.
Oh, yeah. It was part of a proud tradition, but what I'm really saying is, from this rule writer's standpoint, I saw it firsthand.
Yeah, so, another story along those lines, and I won't go into specifics, but there was a particular rule proposal, very controversial, that had grown out of some of the hearings that we had done, and the staff had worked very hard, and our recommendation had been made to the commission, and I get a call from the I guess with this chairman, it was probably from his executive director, but anyway, we want you to withdraw the recommendation. He said, I don't withdraw recommendations. Well, the chairman is very unhappy. He doesn't want it. This was after Government of the Sunshine, so it would be an open meeting. And we can talk about Government of the Sunshine and how would I think it affected the commission. But any of that, I said, I don't withdraw recommendations. I believe in the recommendation. You can reject the recommendation. The chairman can fire me, but I'm not withdrawing your recommendation. And he said, well, we just don't want... And I said, look, the staff has worked very hard on this. I want them to go to the commission table. I want them to make a presentation. And that commission can do anything they want. Well, that's what happened. Because I could not go to that staff and say, I went to the staff and I said, look, the commission's going to vote against you, but you're going to go up and make your best argument. And that happened.
Right. Paul Johnson used to call that the down in flames approach. And the fact of the matter is the commission had and has had in the past a proud tradition of standing up for what was right, for what the staff actually believed in. When I was a young attorney, all of the commission meetings were private. The commission meetings were private both at the time of a rulemaking and at the time of an enforcement proceeding. What happened in the early 1970s was that all of a sudden things like the Freedom of Information Act came about, the Government and the Sunshine Act came about, and by the time the mid to late 1970s occurred, you would have a commission meeting that, well, from a young person's standpoint, looked orchestrated. From the standpoint of the public coming in, it looked like it had already occurred in terms of a decision. What were your views about all of that?
Well, let me go back to when I was a young attorney, John. when Hamer Budge was chairman. And
this would have been 1970.
When I came back to the commission from California, it was a very close place then. And commissioners and staff went to lunch together frequently. I don't know how many times that Hamer and his assistants and I and others would go over to the little watering hole next door to the commission on North Capitol Street and have lunch. And you would talk about not always commission business, but you talk about commission business.
Mm-hmm.
And other commissioners would come, and, you know, you would sit around and you'd talk about commission business. So it was something we talked about during the day. They'd convene two or three or four commissioners, and you'd talk about it. And I've always felt that if, first of all, the commissioners, if they could get together in an informal setting, could discuss things, and there would be fewer of what, you know, we put us in the paper that such and such a commissioner opposes this and such and such.
Misunderstandings,
yeah. And those things could be worked out in a more informal basis, not just sitting around a table or dealing through legal assistants or executive assistants. The other thing is that if you have had the opportunity to do those kinds of things, the commissioners could sit down with the staff and explain, look, we really aren't going to be able to do what you want us to do, and here's the reasons, et cetera, and modify the staff ahead of time. And if you tell somebody, in a reasonable manner, you can't do what they're recommending, they'll understand that. But to call you up the day before or the morning of the hearing and say, we're not going to approve this and we don't want you to make the recommendation, just doesn't work just from a staff standpoint. I think that the government and the Sunshine Act has had a great impact. I agree with you that a lot of these commission meetings look, sound like they're scripted. I don't know whether they are or not, and I don't know that it matters, but it hurts the decision-making process for an agency like the commission. Now, when I was there, it was a much smaller agency, which also made a difference. I mean, you've got a large agency, it's harder to spend time with the top people, but even so, the demands on their time. But I think it's had an impact. Before we leave rulemaking and the like, and go on to some other things I'd like to talk about, I'd like to go back to an effort that came up in the mid-70s, and that was the Federal Securities Code.
Lou Loss. The fellow who taught you securities law at Harvard but didn't get into the details.
Right. Well, the American Law Institute and the reporter was Professor Loss. For many years have been working on a federal securities code, which would have codified all of the securities laws. The 33 Act, the 34 Act, the Investment Advisors Act, the Investment Company Act, the Public Utility Holding Company Act, which the commission for years has wanted to get rid of anyway, and maybe some other statutes. And it was a very comprehensive code. Definitions applied across the statutes. Many, many substantive changes. For example, in the 33 Act area, stockholders could force a company without contractual rights to register securities, which always troubled me. But in any event, the code was finally approved by the Institute. Phil Loomis, who was a commissioner, and Al Sommer, who was a commissioner, were very supportive of the code. In the past, senior staff of the commission had been supportive. And it came to pass that Congress wasn't going to consider this piece of legislation unless they heard from the commission on it, and it was supported by the commission, which meant that Professor Ross and others had to come in to the commission and make a presentation or make presentations to the staff so the staff could formulate recommendations to the commission as to what position they would take if the legislation was introduced. The Professor Loss had always been a very proud man and also, let's put it this way, believed that he was right. So he was not very happy about junior staff members being me when I was an associate director and Ted Sande, who's the other one I can remember, junior staff members, having to make a presentation to them and defend this elaborate code which had gone through the process of the American Law Institute and had the support of at least two commissioners and others that have been commissioners. But we were troubled by this for a number of reasons. I mean, there were substantive provisions that were troublesome. And I gave you an example.